You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Which prevent Roma girls from access to education, focusing specifically on Bulgaria. Over in Saul Zilka, moderating the panel with Dasmin on the topic of government approaches to the school reintegration of girl-child mothers is Mr. Turner Baugh, who is the co-founder and executive director of Purposeful Productions. Turner is a global advocate for education, a champion of girls, and a development expert and co-founder of a movement-building hub for adolescent girls in the Global South. And as a former refugee, he founded and led Sierra Leone's Children's Parliament as well. Joining them is Teresa Kaka-Effa, the Nigerian country representative of Rise Up. She is a policy and advocacy expert on reproductive, maternal, newborn, child, and adolescent health. And her policy formation and advocacy efforts have led to the increased funding of health services. She played a significant role in supporting civil society efforts that led to the passage of the National Health Act in 2014 in Nigeria. And finally, Ms. Chichi Ndiaye, the Senior Associate in the Reproductive Health Program at the Population Council. Her work in girls' education in Kenya has focused on both developing and testing interventions that are geared towards changing social norms that have facilitated both the re-entry and the retention of teenage mothers in and to school. And she directs and provides strategic and technical oversight for the Population Council's Africa Regional School and Gender, Sexual and Gender-Based Violence Network that designs, implements, and tests innovative response models to sexual and gender-based violence in low-resource settings. So at the end of those two concurrent panels, we will break for lunch, and we've asked the moderators to remind the audience to allow our speakers and panelists to grab lunch first, because they will be sitting at designated tables in Saul Zilka for those of you who would like to reach out to them and continue the conversation from the panels, from the morning panels, as well as the afternoon. So I hope you'll take advantage of that time to be able to seek them out right after those concurrent panels during the lunch hour. Please let them grab their food first. So this room will also be available for lunch, and hopefully it's not too cold for those of you who would enjoy some time outside in the somewhat fresh air. There are some benches outside as well. So without further ado, I would like for you all to choose which panel you would like to go to, and we'll meet back up in just a few minutes with our moderators beginning those panels. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us. I don't know if the people at the end of the room at the back can hear me. If you can hear me, can you just indicate? Ah, good. Brilliant. My son there just put his hand up. I think he's saying that he can hear me. Thanks for joining us for this panel. My name is Cherin Oba. I think we've already had the introductions in the other room, so we're going to try not to spend too much time on that. On this panel, we will be discussing government approaches to school reintegration of girl-child mothers, and we're going to base our discussion off the excellent work that Dasmin here has just done, and she's just presented for us. But we have experts as well from different contexts, from Kenya, Nigeria, and it's an issue that I have also worked on a little bit from the Sierra Leone context. So throughout the discussion, we will all be drawing from our experiences on this issue. I just wanted to say as a framing that when you think about girls' education and exclusion of girls, Jamaica doesn't really often feature in these conversations. I see a lot of familiar faces in this room. We've all been to a number of these conversations, and it's not often the case that Jamaica is the case study. And yet, when you read, and I recommend that you do that, by the way, the work that Dasmin has done here at Brookings, you will see that this is exactly the kind of context that we should all be paying attention to. And for me, one of the things that's motivated my work in this field, and I see, especially when it comes to girls' education, is that the big numbers can lie. And as Dasmin was saying, when you take Jamaica, you'll see that they've achieved, it's actually a very positive example overall, if you're taking the big numbers at face value. Yet, when you deconstruct those numbers, when you question those numbers, you begin to see again pockets of exclusion, pockets of marginalization. And I think that's at the heart of it is part of the bigger problem that we face in our work, especially working around girls' issues. We also see specifically on this issue of pregnancy and girls and schools, when I look at it, there seems to be different categories of approaches from governments. There are some governments that are trying to do something about it. There are some governments that agree that education is a right, and it's a right that doesn't change because a girl is pregnant, and they're doing everything to make sure that girls continue to have access to education. And then there are some governments that their attitude is that, well, girls have the right to education, but when they are pregnant, it's a problem, and so we have to deal with, we have to punish them and yet find a way for them to come back to school. And then there are some that we've all, some of you will have read, Magufuli, who is the president of Tanzania, who says, well, if you're pregnant, that's it, you can come back to school. We faced a similar situation as well in Sierra Leone. So we're going to try to think about all these things and look at them from different layers. But let me start with you, Dasmin. Thank you again. I'm sorry. I just think that the introductions we just did in the rooms there was enough. So, and you all have the bios here, so I'm not going to take your time again in going through who these excellent panelists are. But Dasmin, the first question I want to ask is, as I just said, Jamaica is not really what's on top of our minds often, but how is your work and drawing attention to these issues helping us all from a global perspective to understand this issue better and to deal with girls' marginalization in general?
Thank you very much. And you rightly position it, because we pride ourselves so much on doing well, but many times we fail to look at what is not working for us. And so my work is opening up awareness that, yes, Jamaica is not Africa and it's not India, but we have our own level of uniqueness. And if we don't take the time out to get a better understanding, even my own country folks, many of us are yet to understand the implication of teenage pregnancy. Many of us still don't know that it exists because of our high status in life. And we are not acquainted with the girls who are being disenfranchised. So my work is opening up awareness and inviting the attention of all critical actors, both locally and globally, to say, yes, here is a situation that needs some level of attention, and we all should be partnering to ensure that we improve the life circumstances for these girls.
Thank you so much. Chishi, I want to come to you. At the Population Council, where I used to work just a year ago, whenever we talk about reintegration of girls in school, I think everybody turns to the work that you have done, the research that you have done, and your work particularly in this field. Maybe help us to understand a little bit about what you're doing specifically in the Kenyan context to facilitate reintegration of girl mothers into the school system.
Sure, thank you. The Kenyan context is interesting because on paper, it's a really enabling environment. So we have a school reentry policy, which is really supposed to facilitate girls returning to school after they've dropped out due to pregnancy. We also have the National School Health Policy, which is supposed to ensure that school personnel remain supportive of pregnant girls so that they remain in school for as long as they are willing and able to. So between those two policies, you would think that things would work better on the ground. But the policy hasn't really been well implemented or operationalized. And so what we've been doing with the government is to just introduce simple interventions, simple in quotes, such as policy dialogues. We've been working with the government to hold policy dialogues with school principals. We've tried this in one county. There are 47 counties in Kenya. And in Homa Bay County, where we've done this, it's just been a matter of convening all the school principals. We convened all principals of public secondary schools that were either girls only or mixed, just to talk about the policy. During the very first policy dialogue that we held, there were about 200 principals in the room at least, and the first question I asked them was, how many of you have ever seen the school reentry policy for girls, and you could have heard a pin drop and no one raised their hand? And they simply said, we've never seen it. And 20% had never heard of it. A third, based on our survey, had never heard of the National School Health Policy. So, as you can imagine, these are the people that are supposed to be helping to implement the policy, school principals, and they've never seen the key policy on paper. The Ministry of Education has also run out of copies, so even I couldn't find one. So these are some of the issues. And for many, this was the first time that they had a chance to understand what the contents of this policy were, what their role was, what their role is as school principals in helping ensure that girls remain in school or return to school. And the policy dialogues are designed to be just a day long, and also to give principals a chance to sort of give their own opinion and sort of take ownership. You know, what are the barriers? What would make it difficult to implement this? What are you already doing that, you know, we may not know about because you haven't been well supported, so on and so forth. And we found that creating the awareness through the dialogues, in addition to sort of community media campaigns, has really made a difference in Homa Bay County. And what we're trying to do is sort of extend those methods to the rest of the country.
Wonderful. We're going to come back and try to understand that better and also talk about the, I think, some parallels between what you're experiencing there in terms of just knowledge of the policy and I think that means work. But, Madam Tessy, in the Nigerian context, I know you're the country representative of Rise Up. What do you do on this specific issue?
Okay, our mandate in Rise Up is actually to advance education, health, and gender equity for girls, women, and youth. And we work specifically with civil society organizations and also identifying girls' leaders to help them amplify their voice and begin to talk more about girls' education and support interventions around that area. We build their capacity in terms of strengthening them to understand policies and engage in dialogue to discuss policy implementation. In Nigeria, we are not short of policies. We are not short of programs or laws that suggest girls or support girls to be in school or support young people to be in school, especially in basic education. But the bigger the challenge that we have is implementing and translating those policies into actual actions at that level. And so we support civil society leaders, we support girls to begin to advocate and amplify and draw attention of the government to such policies and the reason why they should implement those policies.
Can I just ask, how big is this problem in Nigeria?
It is big. I'm shamefully sitting here to say, shamefully, that Nigeria contributes to about 10.5 million children out of the basic school system. And if we look at that number, that was like in 2008. And with the insurgency, we have added to that number. So roughly, especially because there's no accurate data, roughly I could say 10.5 million. And we equate that number to the population of Liberia, for instance. So the population of Liberia is like 4.7 as we speak in 2007. And so if this is like double the population of Liberia for children aged 6 to 11 who are out of the basic system. So the problem is enormous. And then if you even begin to talk about the reintegration of, you know, school-age mothers, school mothers and all that, it is even hidden within the problem because already the number of children who are, you know, out of school are really enormous. And then I think at this point we need to understand how this Nigeria, the system of government in Nigeria. At the federal level, the Ministry of Health and the Minister of Women and Affairs are responsible for policy, for turning out policies, coordinating interventions and all of that. But implementation of those policies are at the subnational levels and the local levels. And those are the levels that are weak in terms of funding, you know, education and all of that. So that really is the big and major problem that we face in Nigeria. Now, Nigeria also has what we call the Universal Basic Act, which stipulates that children I mean, supports this 6334 system, which is the 6 years basic education, 6 years primary education, 3 years junior education, and 3 years secondary education. But it is compulsory from primary to the junior secondary. And the junior secondary at age 11 or 12, you're out of, you know, the system where it is free. It's supposed to be free, qualitative, and compulsory. However, there are hidden costs to that. So at the school level, you see the principal charging for textbooks, sometimes uniform, and all of those hidden costs also present a lot of barriers for children not to even be in school.
Wow, so, okay. One of the things I found fascinating about your work, Dasmin, is around invisibility of some of the proposed beneficiaries of this policy. I think, you know, you have a progressive policy, and yet you were saying that a good number of potentially intended beneficiaries get lost in the system. And I think one of your recommendations is to keep a better record of girls who get pregnant. And I was also looking at the way the policy operates in Jamaica. Apparently, so the girls go into the program, and then for reintegration, they can get reintegrated into different schools. So not necessarily into the school that they used to go to before. And in all of that, some of the girls will get lost in the system. I want you to speak a little bit about on this particular issue of the invisibility, both in terms of counting, but also keeping data, but also just how pregnancy basically makes girls invisible and how that contributes to the marginalization of girls, specifically in relation to our continuing education.
Okay, thank you. So when a girl gets pregnant while in school, and you'll imagine it will take some time before it starts showing, when that becomes public knowledge, then that girl knows that her place is no longer there. So she leaves the school system. This girl can become invisible if the system does not pick her up and refer her to the women's center where she can continue her education. And luckily for that girl, sometimes because of heightened awareness in community, then some of the referrals may be done by even community personnel. Now, if this girl doesn't have the interest to return to school, then she can get lost. And further, you made a reference to the fact that it is not necessary that the girl has to return to the formal system that she was already enrolled in. This too creates another challenge. Even though it makes leverage for choice, it creates another problem. Because, yes, everybody understands the fact that education is important for these girls. But you can have educational administrators who may decide that, oh, I don't want to take any of these girls. And she could, or he could confuse the situation by delaying the process of the girl returning to school, or if they don't do that, they will prefer to take another girl who was once enrolled in another context. And this, they say, the girl would come to their perspective very fresh. No one would know their status, and the level of discrimination would be reduced.
They're actually interested in ensuring that nobody knows that the girl, this particular girl, has ever been pregnant before.
Very much correct.
Has had a
very
child.
Much correct.
So that right. Their preference is to get a girl that nobody knows about. In
exactly.
This way.
And for those who do take back their own student, if the school operates a shift system, so let's say the girl was enrolled on the morning shift, then the girl is hidden now on the evening shift. So nobody knows that girl. And what becomes disheartening too is the fact this whole protection around the girl also hides that girl from accessing services. Because in order to support the system and to ensure that the girl benefits from all the social services that are in place for her, we have guidance counselors and social workers employed to our school system. And this is their role, to support the girls, to helping them to succeed. So I was very amazed and distressed when I enter a number of schools and I speak with the guidance counselors and they say they don't know who the girls are. They have never been introduced to them. And some of them said they don't even know the provisions under the policy. And I said, really? So these are the persons who we are paying to take care of these girls and they are not equipped and armed enough to provide the services. And where you don't have the support following the girl in the way that she needs to get it, then a girl can drop out of school or she can decide to just go whenever she likes because there's no one looking out for her interest. And when you speak to other persons, when you ask about special services that are in place for the girls, they would say every girl in their institution receives the same treatment. So there's no special services for them in some institution. And already you know that they're already from a disadvantaged situation. They have their own challenges and would need additional and special support. So these are some of the things that are contributing to the invisibility of the girl. And one of the things that I found most startling is having visited one of these institutions and the administrator happens to be a male principal, and he related a story about a twin that was enrolled at the institution, and both of them became pregnant. And when I asked to see if I could speak with the girls, then I was told that they no longer attend the institution. And then I asked why. And he would reel off this long story to say that they're always getting in trouble, they are disrupting the school, and even when he tries to have dialogue with the father, now these girls were now in the care and custody of their father. And when he tries to talk to him, he takes it to mean that the school is bringing an attention to his daughters unfairly. And those two girls were no longer attending school. And if you don't actually get down to the implementation level, you don't know that this situation exists. And we, at the policy level, we are there thinking that, yes, this wonderful service is in place and everybody is benefiting. But if you don't drill down, you don't know what is actually happening at the implementation level. So this is contributing to a lot of invisibility of a number of our girls who really need to benefit from the service that is in place for them.
Chichi, this must sound familiar to you as well, yeah, in terms of in your Kenyan context. And I know earlier today we talked a lot about, we had this morning about the invisibility and marginalization of Maasai girls. But how does being a girl mother also kind of perpetuate this invisibility and marginalization in the Kenyan context? And you can kind of see what reflects on the parallels as well with the Jamaican context.
Yeah, some of the things Desmond has talked about are actually similar to what we find in Kenya. But first of all, I think the invisibility starts from the level of policy. Because the school reentry policy, the way in which it's written, it implies that as soon as a girl gets pregnant, she needs to leave school. Now, this clashes with the national school health policy, which indicates that a girl can remain in school, a pregnant girl can remain in school for as long as she's willing or able. So when you bring the two together, and that's one of the things we did during our policy dialogues, you can see how it's a source of confusion for principals. Mm-hmm. They don't understand when a girl should she be sent away. If she's sent away, when does she come back? So there's no, the policies were clearly put together without, they don't speak to one another. So that's one of the ways in which we see the invisibility in the school reentry policy. It indicates that, you know, she basically should leave school, but she should be supported over time so that she eventually does come back. But of course, we know in, you know, low resource settings, that's not really going to happen. So once she leaves, she's pretty much gone. But in addition, the school reentry policy indicates that school principals should provide support for girls to gain entry into other schools, so not the schools in which they got pregnant. Perhaps it was due to a concern about stigma or whatnot. You know, we don't really know. But what we do find among the girls that we've worked with is that many actually do choose to go back to the same school. So these are some
surprise.
Of the just the little ways,
I mean, so, right? Like
the little ways in
like
which, yeah, they're sort of made to to seem invisible. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to point out that Desmond, in your work, I really like that section where you were saying when you talk to the girls, none of them reported this discomfort in the school, right? Like pretty much none of the girls will tell you that, oh, we're undergoing this extreme discomfort and shame. Yet 67% of the principals say that, you know, our concern is that the girls are uncomfortable in the school. So there's sense of, oh, the principals and the authorities say one thing, but the girls in their own experience, they're like, you know, I'm happy to be in school. I have my friends. I'm just trying to take it one day at a time. What's the experience in Nigeria for you, Tessie?
I think for the purpose of this, I would like to just present a little background about how Nigeria is run. I would look at the southern part of Nigeria, which is predominantly Christian. And, of course, teenage pregnancy, being an adolescent mother, is still considered stigma. And so if a girl, you know, falls pregnant or delivers and all of that, the reintegration into school is more on a personal basis or individual or family basis, I would say. And she would always want to go to a different school, perhaps just leave the community entirely and go to a different school. And that is if the parents have value for education, they have the resources to support her, to provide care for the child she leaves behind and all of that. So that is determined by all of that. But in the northern part where early marriage is within union, so to speak, which we are still fighting, the girl child is still considered, that adolescent mother is still, does not suffer that level of stigma, so to speak. But there is really no conscious effort from the government to reintegrate the children. So whatever we see at that level is basically interventions from civil society organizations, from donor agencies. UNFPA is doing a lot. There was also the United States Ambassador Initiative, which was also initiated to bring back girls to school. But those centers are actually carved out specifically for those girls who are married and have children, and they provide crutches and some level of support. And then within the community, they engage also the traditional leaders, the husbands, so that they could provide some level of care for the children. For those whose children are big enough to stay at home, they could provide care for them until the mothers go back to school. But usually that is not sustained. Sometimes because it's a project and it's time-driven, it has a lifespan. When the initiative is done, it just fizzles out. So that really is not sustained. And then most times the government is not ready to begin to implement that or take that initiative further or expand or scale up that.
Speaking of governments, I want us to talk, transition a little bit to what the specific responsibilities of governments are and how governments are balancing these priorities. And I maybe just want to start by talking about the experience we have in Sierra Leone. So before now, before the outbreak of Ebola a few years ago, it was the policy was mostly unspoken. So it depended on the school. So if you went to a school where the principal was progressive, you could get pregnant and stay in class, and you could come back and take your exams. And afterwards, as long as, you know, you're able to come back to school, you're welcome to come back to school. And I know that, Chichi, with your research, you know that irrespective of that, majority of girls who get pregnant don't come back to school anyway. But the policy was much more liberal and it depended. Some principals, of course, in the more conservative schools will say, you're pregnant and you are out. Yet, after the Ebola outbreak, when schools were closed for a year, a number of girls were pregnant to the extent that it became like a visible phenomenon. You could tell that most of the girls who had been sitting out for the whole year had gotten pregnant, and girls of particularly school-going age. And so the government decided at that time that they were then going to pass a policy and said, if you're pregnant, you're not welcome to come back to school. So if you know, you couldn't find a worse time for the introduction of a policy that had a blanket ban on pregnant girls from school. So even schools where girls were able to go back before now, Bengal. So we started this whole, you know, international campaign trying to put pressure on the government to change the policy. And at the end of the day, what, you know, obviously the reasons that they gave are similar to what you've talked about, this notion that it will be stigma, that pregnancy is somehow infectious. If you're sitting next to one pregnant girl, you're also going to catch the pregnancy, and the other girls will get, you know. So it was, I think I wrote at the time that it was not really based on any sound research or any sound fact at all. But that was the policy we had to deal with. But what we ended up kind of working with the government on was the creation of an alternative system. Our fear, obviously, was that, I mean, for those of you who know, Sierra Leone is one of the poorest countries in the world, and the school system itself, the standard school system itself, is so badly run. You don't even have female teachers. You don't have the right facilities. So here they're creating an education system for people that they think are morally inferior. Now, you can figure out what type of education that is going to be and how easy it was going to be for those girls who are in this school system. So they've just now done the evaluation of the second year evaluation of this program in Sierra Leone, and there are some interesting findings about number of girls who are now reconsidering going back to school. Again, we don't have figures yet about how many of them that have been successful in getting back into the school system, but I think the government is trumpeting some success with this scheme in terms of how they've been able to balance what they claim were the concerns of the public in terms of their fear that pregnant girls will sit in the same school or pregnant girls wearing uniform. So from the government's perspective in Jamaica, what's the position and how are they balancing their stated goal of trying to provide education for everyone and this issue of girls who get pregnant and the concerns you point in your study about school administrators or the public saying, oh, yes, but we don't want them to be sitting in class with our students.
Okay, so let me address that in two tranches. The government is very much in support of the girls benefiting from a second chance education, and we have pumped a lot of resources behind that. And we have also partnered with our Women's Center, which is a limited liability company. In former years, it was totally owned by the government. So we provide subvention to ensure that the girls, when they're excluded, they can continue their education. So the support is there. And the mere fact that we have made provision for guidance counselors and social workers is also acknowledging the fact that these girls need support. The principals, for the most part, most of them are in support of the girls getting a second chance education. But the challenge with some of them is that they would prefer not to have those girls return to them. Send them somewhere else. And they have not indicated where we should send them, which is, again, opening up the platform for further discussion. Send them somewhere else, but where should we send them? So we'd want to have that dialogue to see what is it that they are proposing. But you have other administrators who are with open arms, they take them, because what number of them say is that when they come to them, the mere fact that they had undergone all these counseling and mentoring, then they come to their setting with a fresh perspective. Others see them as potential troublemakers. And some principals even punish them by not allowing them to graduate, even though they would have done very well. And we are talking about some of these traditional high-stake.
You may not allow to attend the graduation ceremony.
Right, right. Don't wear you're not worthy of wearing the noble institution's graduation garb because you short-circuited the process. That is how you have some persons behaving. But we, in Jamaica, value very much our human capital. I mentioned it already in the presentation. We need everybody to succeed. We need all our persons to participate in the development of the country. So this is something that, now that awareness has been created, I am certain that we are going to become more visible in the space and also seek to see how well we can garner resources to ensure that the policy is evaluated down to the T so that we can pick up every single gap that needs to be closed.
Tessie, how different is that posture from the posture of the government of Nigeria, and how What are the opportunities there for NGOs, community organizations to influence the attitude of governments?
I will start with the opportunities now. Currently, the Universal Basic Education Act is undergoing review, and the civil society is very much involved in the review. And we are asking for specific provisions to be inserted in that review. One, to increase the free compulsory education up to secondary school level. So you would have now the 13 to 17 girls still in school, which will also, if well implemented in the north, will be able to address early marriage and all of that. And then we are also including, you know, this aspect to be written specifically, that special attention must be given, you know, to reintegrate pregnant girls in school. And then one of the things that didn't really go well with the implementation of the act was the fact that at the federal level was supposed to provide 50% of funding for education, and at the subnational level was supposed to do a counterpart funding to be able to implement education services at the subnational and local level. And that was not happening because the subnational governments and the local government said they didn't have that kind of money to match what was coming from the federal level. And so what we are also asking in that review is to increase what the federal government will give perhaps to 70%, and then make the states either give 30% or lower, depending on how we will push the argument or the negotiations. But we're asking the federal government to give more from the consolidated revenue and funds that will be from the federal government.
Tessie, I'm just going to follow up quickly. You just said that the problem in Nigeria is not the presence of policies. You said it's implementation. How hopeful are you that this is going to...
Yeah, but now implementation. And it goes back to even what Chichi was saying earlier. Sometimes this is not disseminated at the local... Most times the policies are done at the federal level. And the states are supposed to understand, be part of it, and implement at that level. And there is a disconnect sometimes understanding when the policy is not disseminated at the local level. And so the civil society intervene by taking that policy and opening dialogue for the subnational government to understand that there is provision for this and begin to work, you know, to advocate for the implementation. So we are hoping, first of all, there must be an enabling environment. There must be something that would support, you know, your argument or support, you know, the fact that you're calling attention, you know, for the government to implement this. If there's no fallback, no legal provision, so to speak, you won't have, you know, a basis for argument.
All right. There's so much we can go into on this, but I want to give you a chance, Chichi, as well, to speak about. I know you've been working on, as well, analyzing the government's approach in Kenya, as you've spoken about. I want to give you a chance to maybe speak a little bit about that in terms of the government's approach and attitude to the reentry policy in Kenya. And if you can speak about what happens throughout that process when a girl gets pregnant immediately afterwards and when she delivers the baby with respect to the policy and the government in
sure.
Kenya.
Thanks. What typically happens is a girl gets pregnant in some schools actually do a mandatory pregnancy testing, you know, every term. And so when that's discovered, then the girl is expelled. Actually, the National School Health Policy, although it's quite progressive compared to the other educational policies around this subject, it also recommends voluntary pregnancy testing for girls. Now, how voluntary those tests are is very questionable, because if a principal says you have to get tested, no girl is going to say, I would rather not, and I know my rights, and you can't make me do it. So there's a lot of you know, controversy contained even within the more progressive policies. And so typically what typically happens is it's really just expulsion, or at the most, the girl's parents are called in, the situation is explained to them, and they're asked to take their child home. But I will say that with the policy dialogues that we've been doing with the government, we are seeing some interesting changes at the county level. For example, after we'd done this policy dialogue a couple of times, the Homa Bay County Department of Education decided on their own that they were going to start tracking the number of girls that re-enter school, you know, after getting pregnant. And they decided to do it with their own funds, and they did that, you know, throughout the life of our project. In addition to that, at the end of last year, on their own, of their own volition, they instituted a prize for the top two primary schools and top two secondary schools that had shown the most support for reentering girls. In other words, had the highest numbers or something like that. And they asked us if we wouldn't mind buying the trophies, that this is a prize that they would like to institute, and we were delighted to do so. In addition, within our policy dialogues, we tried to engage local politicians and bring them into the dialogues to see the data that we were collecting, listen to the findings, and also listen to the concerns and challenges of school principals. And out of that, early this year, the women's representative of this particular county, she set up a bursary scheme specifically for girls that are reentering school and for children with disabilities. So there are a number of changes, you know, that are occurring as a result of school principals feeling like they've been included, they matter, they're being respected, and their concerns, even if we may not be able to address all of them, at least they feel like they're being heard. So we found, you know, and school principals doing things of their own volition. For example, some would report to us about how, oh, I've created a nursing zone for my student mothers, you know, things that they didn't have to do, didn't have the money to do. Another principal told us about how, well, what I do is with my married girls who have had children, they come to me and I give them special days to go to the clinic, to go out and get their family planning method. So these are all the stories that we used the policy dialogue to sort of give voice to encourage other principals to become more supportive. So it's not all bad news. Some good things are happening. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. I think that's a really good note for us to transition to inviting questions from the audience. It's not all bad news. Good things are happening. As somebody who considers myself a champion, a fighter for girls' rights, I like to take that as a positive, but it's such a discomfiting positive, right? That, oh yeah, things are, it's not all bad. Some good things are happening, right? It's not the fault of us on the panel. Of course, you have to take what you can get and start building off there. But it tells you as well from everything we've had from our panelists here that the issues we're dealing with are so complex, and the forces, the structures are designed in most cases to limit access of girls, and especially the poorest and the most marginalized. And by the way, those are the girls that get pregnant the most at the youngest ages. I think we've not talked about that directly here, but I know that for this audience, you guys will know that. Anyway, you can indicate if you have a question, put up your hand. So we'll take a few together. Jenny first, close to you.
Hi, Jenny Gamble from Discovery Learning Alliance, and thank you all for the great presentations and for your insights. I have two question comments. First for Desmine, one of your recommendations was to develop a database to capture this information, and so I'm curious if you've had different discussions with EMIS, Education Management Information System administrators, around different flags or indicators that could be included to indicate and designate different dropout reasons. So first question to that. The other is more general for all of the panelists. And Chichi, you kind of hit on this slightly when you talked about clinics. I've had different conversations about this reentry issue over the past couple of years, and it's always kind of come up that, you know, we keep focusing on the education systems, which of course that's very important to, you know, activate those policies that are in place. But it's also come up that perhaps more of a cross-sectoral approach could be helpful and kind of more incentivized by going the direction, starting perhaps with more infant care. So thinking about clinics as potential platforms or places where, you know, knowing that a girl has a right to return to school, kind of educating those clinic workers, of course, knowing that the child's likely to be more healthy and to have better health outcomes if the mother is educated, if that is a potential relationship to promote and to expand on. So kind of thinking about health clinics and early child care as potential points of intervention to encourage girls to return to school, and education around their rights, and different ways in which they can do that. So kind of what are those pathways? So kind of a question for all of you around, have you seen that happening anywhere? Has that been brought up in any way? And just kind of curious as to see if that cross-sectoral approach might be another strategy to kind of come at this, not so directly through education, but kind of through the side door.
Brilliant, thank you. I think we're going to take a couple more, and then we'll get the responses here. The lady with the glasses there. Yeah.
Oh. Meredith Gould, consultant. So picking up on the multi-sector and across-ministry approach, this past spring I worked with UNICEF and the government of Liberia, and one of the things that they wanted to do was look at an adolescent empowerment strategy versus a sector-specific strategy. And my challenging charge was to look at the education strategy, the girls strategy, the health strategy. And what UNICEF did that was really great was develop a steering committee, although it was requested by youth and sports, across five ministries. And when we were intentional about being thematic and population focused, Liberia has more than 50% adolescents and one of the highest rates of teen pregnancy and out of school youth, particularly girls. What I found just from the person developing it, but from a sort of non-ministry perspective, was that when we designed the strategy and then we're looking at implementation afterwards, we went and intentionally earmarked each existing strategy in each ministry, which is basically very sector specific, and used the language that was already there. And then really decided that adolescence and the empowerment of that, and what we were intentional about was pregnant girls and teen parents, because Liberia doesn't have a policy on it. And we were intentional even across the thematic areas in the strategy, which were not ministry specific, to tie education to health, also to justice. So my question is to piggyback on that. I'm now working in Tanzania, really challenged around even a girls' education program in pregnancy. I'm curious to piggyback, would a multi-ministry or a multi-sector intervention that puts girls or adolescents at the center versus education or health or psychosocial perhaps be a creative and negotiated, tricky, good tool to particularly look at this most vulnerable group of teen moms and parents?
Brilliant. Thank you. Take the final question here, and then we'll come to the panel.
Hi, thank you. I'm Megan Donahue, a consultant, but I just returned from Africa where I was gender advisor for Peace Corps. And one thing that I experienced, and I'm just wondering if you have any best practices about what happens in the teacher education training where maybe where this kind of enabling environment might be discussed, or ways to work with parents or other students or teachers and principals. And I wondered if any of you have examples of that in your countries. Okay, thank you.
Can you say where you were in Africa? Sorry.
I'm sorry?
Can you say where you were in Africa?
Well, I was based in Ghana.
In Ghana,
but I
okay.
worked in all 25 countries.
So. Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Can you find if I asked her to repeat that?
Sorry. Dasmi wants you to repeat the question. I didn't think she got it clear. Yeah.
The question is, do you have any examples of in the teacher training colleges where future teachers are being, maybe would find out the information about how to deal with reintegration of girls?
It's training.
Okay, and working with parents and other students and principals.
Okay. Great. All right, so I think we have some solid questions here and great perspectives as well from all of you. I know we have a lot of experience in the room. So I'm going to start with you, Dasmi. There was some specific questions specifically around the data database that you were referring to, whether you've looked into that, and then if you have any perspective on the last question around whether this can be incorporated as well into the or whether you know this exists already in teacher training, and then there are two specific questions around the multi-sectoral approach to this issue.
I think I'm going to tie the multi-sectoral approach and the database together because that's critical. Yes, we have a multi-sectoral approach in Jamaica because they're the agency that track the numbers, and that's our Registered General's Department. So they know who the girls are, and then will make reference to the system for support. Plus, we have, you made reference, Jenny, to the causes of the problem in the first place. And we are finding out that a number of these girls have been molested, and that's why they get pregnant in the first place. And there are other attendant challenges that they encounter. So we have an agency which we call SISOCA that takes care of those girls who would have been molested and report those to the system. So we have our, and then we have our women's center too, who collect their own level of data. And then in the Ministry of Education, we collect our own data. So what is not happening is that the data, they are not merging together. So there are things happening in pockets, but it is not linked. We have a national census platform in the Ministry of Education, which provides information on our students, from performance to enrollment and matriculation or whatever. But what is missing at this point is drilling down to that granular level where we can make sense of what actually is happening. So bringing all the data from our different partners together will help the system. It will help all of us because we'll have an understanding what is happening and where we need to step up our effort more. In terms of exposing the information at the teacher training level, I don't think we have that. But what we do have, because in the Ministry of Education, there is a unit which is called the Guidance Counseling Unit. And that department do sensitization from time to time in our schools. And that is how many of our teachers would learn about the provision under the policy. And more specifically, the guidance counselors who are charged with monitoring the welfare of the girls. So that is how the dissemination takes place. But you will understand that from time to time, then you'll have new teachers coming into the system. And if the process is not repeated, then some persons may not know what is happening. It's different for us because our policy, while we may not have everybody having a printed version of the policy, it is on the Ministry of Education website. But how many persons are aware of that is another issue. So the information is there. I guess we just need to start talking louder and talking to all the different persons to know that, to let them know that the provision is there. They just need to get familiar with it, and so that all of us need to understand what our roles are, because we all have roles, including me, at the ministerial level.
Okay. Thank you. Chuchi, there is a lot of energy around dealing with this issue, not only as an education issue, but from multiple fronts, right, and using that as entry points to support. How is that? What do you think about that approach in the Kenyan context and with the work that you're doing specifically on this issue?
I mean, I'm glad the comment came up. I think that there's a lot of room to apply a multisectoral approach. And we do realize, recognize the need for that. And so this is why over the next 2.5 years, our approach to working with the government is actually now about getting the sectors to talk to one another. And because we, through our interventions, we have proven that we can get girls to get back, to return to school, but we're not sure that we can retain them once they return, because we know that repeat pregnancies are a problem, and the principals know this, and so on and so forth. So we are now trying to figure out how to get at least health and education, perhaps maybe gender, to begin talking together, working with one another. I mean, the National School Health Policy was supposedly developed by both the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education, has both logos, both names. But what happens along the way when it comes to implementation, more support is needed. So that's one direction in which we want to go. Can I also speak to the other question about the teachers' training and so on and so forth? That does not exist at this time in Kenya, but we really recognize the need for it, and that's one of our recommendations, actually, in our report, you know, around this study, that it really is needed. Because if you think about it, we're talking about principals and teachers whose teachers' training has been It's been very much focused on discipline, morality, so on and so forth. And then they get into the school system and they're expected to implement a policy that's built on rights, which is something that they have not understood at all. As far as they're concerned, children don't really have rights. So there really is a need to start it right from the teachers' training colleges so that we have, you know, a more prepared group of, so that we don't have to do policy dialogues with principals.
Right? How different
because
is
they
the,
already would have known about them.
How different is the Nigerian context? Do you have that already in your teacher training
program? We do not have that. But in terms of multi-sectoral approach, we have policies, especially we have situations where we are driving adolescent youth-friendly health services, even at the school level. Okay, so, and then we are also setting up platforms or encouraging platforms where Ministry of Education and Ministry of Health are working together and discussing, especially looking at access to contraceptives for young people at that level, education in terms of teenage pregnancy, in terms of HIV infection and all of that, so that the students at whatever level have information that would also protect them from early marriage, teenage pregnancy, and all of that.
Brilliant. Well, I was just going to say also on the multisectoral approach that in Sierra Leone, the alternative schooling system that they created is run by both the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education, and Social Welfare Ministry is also involved in that. Now, again, I cannot speak about how well that one is working out, but the idea is that they are integrated services. And in fact, in the next iteration of the program, now I'm probably the biggest critic of this program in Sierra Leone. I don't think that girls getting pregnant should kick them out of school at all. I don't think they should create inferior systems for that. But I'm an advocate, so I can do that. But I know that one of the things that they're looking at now is that system is going to now include all girls who have been out of school for more than 2 years. So whether you are a pregnant girl or you just had a baby or not, but if you've been out of the school system for more than 2 years, you're going to be welcome into this alternative school system, and then all of them are going to, they're going to try to walk towards a way to get them to go back into the school system. Of course, my question to that is, well, they were afraid of these pregnant girls kind of influencing these the school girls anyway. I was asking the other day whether that fear does not exist with these other girls who have been out of school, but anyway. I think we might have time for one more question. And if there's any other question in the room, anybody else wanted to ask a question? Okay. If not, I will ask the, I had one last, oh.
I would like to ask.
Okay, good. Yeah.
I am Janelle Nelson with Child International. My question,
Hi, I'm Janelle Nelson with Child Fund International. I just wanted to ask, because this is to Virchichi, specifically I see that you lead a network on SGBV. And I wanted to ask on how your work is related to working with teen moms and how you see that is allowing girls to go back to school for retaining them in school and also not to get pregnant.
Good question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, the work on SGBV and the work on girls return to school, they're sort of separate programs. The SGBV work has been in existence for around 11 years now, and the school reentry work is about 3 years old. But there are definitely connections. So under the SGBV network, we actually have interventions that are running in schools and so are focusing on, you know, school-related gender-based violence. And we also know from our teenage mother work that, you know, some of the pregnancies that we're seeing are actually as a result of sexual violence and so on and so forth. But I think, you know, we need to, you know, look more into how we can connect, you know, those two projects. So far they've sort of been running kind of like on their own, but I definitely do see the connections. The work that we're doing under the SGBV network is really around children who are already in school, and we've not looked at retention issues. We've rather just looked at how do we respond to the violence, you know, that, you know, is happening, you know, to those children who are already survivors. Yeah.
All right, thank you. Well, I think before we go, I just want to give each of you a chance quickly. There's one thing that you think needs, one big thing that you, I know you have just written recommendations for what you think will make a difference, but is there one thing from this conversation that you want the audience to think about, I can make the most difference for reintegrating girls in schools, pregnant girls or girl mothers into the school system? I'll start with you, Desmond.
Generally, I think we all have to get to the point where we really understand the value of education for all, for personal development and also for international development. So let me move it from my context, international development, because this is the way we are going. We need our human capacities to make a difference. And if this is truncated, then it means that some of us are going to be stymied, or economies are going to suffer, or there's going to be perpetuation of poverty, and it will prevent us from achieving the sort of development or making the sort of difference that we need to make internationally. And it will also allow a number of persons to live into disadvantaged situations that none of us wants to ever happen. So education is the way forward. We have acknowledged that, and wherever we can, whatever we can do to support education in any context, then it is important that we all seek to embrace it as much as possible.
Thank you. Tessie?
Okay, I would say Nigeria is a patriarchal society, just like most African context. We must make sure in all our interventions to include the faith-based organization or leaders, the traditional leaders, because whether you're a politician or a policymaker, somehow you're being influenced by those group of people. And so we must include them in our interventions. We must explain to them in the context in which they understand the value of education. We must also count data. I think what is missing is data, not be influencing our policy formulation, our policy implementation, and decision making. So that, for me, is very important. Because if we don't count it, we may not even know the number of people who we are supposed to intervene.
You're going to like that point, right? I know that we talk a lot about counting. Yes.
So what I'd like to say, though, is let's be patient with schools and school personnel. At my first policy dialogue, I went in there thinking that, this was the day that I was going to teach school principals about what the policies say. And that was a very humbling day for me. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the reality of a principal implementing something in a low-resource context. And that was very humbling for me. And I came out of there learning that principals are not my enemies. Schools are our allies. And it's been a wonderful relationship for the last, it's been over 3 years now. And out of that work has come a book chapter called Are School Principals the Bad Guys? Because when you read the literature, that's the impression you come away with. But when you're really there on the ground, you realize that they're really champions. They can be. They have the potential for really being champions. And that's what we've been trying to tap into as the Population Council.